This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you're looking to learn more about our city, you'll be interested in Charlotte City Walks. And in this case, these walks are in the tradition of urban writer and activist Jane Jacobs, who was born 100 years ago. We hear more about her and these walks later in the program. First, it's into the car, but not just any car. A Tesla. Tesla is attempting to transform the auto industry with their electric cars. They've won over a small subset of people by building cars that equal and sometimes exceed the performance and luxury of their gas-powered cousins. But in North Carolina and a few other states, a holdover from the early days of automobiles is holding them back. Tesla likes to sell its cars directly to customers and are about to bring to market a new, less expensive version. This could be their breakthrough car, and in fact, they've already built or already have about 400,000 orders on hand for a car that has yet to be built. But their business model is being challenged here. WFAE's David Borax has been reporting on this. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio, along with Mike Ramsey, who joins us by phone from Detroit. He's an automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to both of you.
Hello, Mike.
Hi. Good morning. Michael, welcome to the show. Before we talk about Tesla's challenges in North Carolina, talk about the car company and the cars they produce. What is their goal, Mike?
Well, Tesla, if you listen to Elon Musk, the CEO and founder of Tesla Motors, what he says the goal of the company is to proliferate the adoption of electric vehicles and end the use of petroleum or carbon-based fuels. So they have been for a while trying to democratize ownership of electric vehicles and lower the barriers to that. So far, since the founding, they mostly sold very expensive vehicles, and even their attempts to sell less expensive vehicles haven't been very successful because the people who want to buy the cars tend to want the most expensive versions. So they've over time, they've kind of dropped their less expensive ones.
And if I understand this correctly, Mike, the reason the people who buy these more expensive cars opt for the more expensive version of that car, which is sold slightly less expensively, is because the more you pay, the longer the charge, the more miles you get. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So they opt for the bigger battery, et cetera.
Absolutely. In fact, Tesla has really proven that people want the range, even though a lot of economists and researchers would say there's no real reason to have an electric car with more than 100 miles of range because virtually no one drives that much in a normal day, so there's no point in getting a battery that size. Nonetheless, people are paying much more money for that.
We're Americans. We always want more. That's how it works. So heretofore, Tesla has mostly sold directly to customers on their website. Does their success at that surprise you? Because they've put, as I said, they have 400,000 orders for this new car that will cost around $35,000 before incentives, and they haven't built the first car except for the model.
The demand for the product is a little higher than I would have anticipated. I think some of that is just that it shows the huge amount of interest in their vehicles, but also the threshold, the cost of the Model S and their new vehicle, the Model X, is so high that it eliminates most normal mortals from purchasing that vehicle. The $35,000, not a cheap car by any means, but it definitely brings it into a broader category of people. Selling online could potentially be very popular with a huge number of people in the United States, but it's frankly not possible because of state laws for any other car maker to do that.
So why did they choose that approach in the first place? Why not just either open dealerships or go to an established dealership group and say, would you carry our car as part of your family of cars?
Okay, their stated reason is that they believe that because of the type of product that they're selling, they need to have people who have no other interest in selling other types of vehicles. And also, they've talked a lot about this, not wanting their retail portal and the service centers to be a profit center, that they want to make money from selling the car, not from, you know, all of the additional things that independent retailers add on to the process in the sale. So they essentially want to break the model of an independent dealer because they feel like the advocates on the other end won't do a good job of selling this new technology because they are conflicted. They have other gas vehicles that they might be able to, you know, in other franchises that might compete with that. So that's one reason. And the other reason is I think that they want to change the distribution model of their, so you build to order. And it's very hard to build to order when the way that car companies work today is they build for dealer orders. So if I'm a dealer, I put an order for 50 cars, and then the car company builds cars, and they come to me, and I get to pick as the dealer what they're going to be like. The way that Tesla works is you go online, you pick out a car, and then it gets built for you and then delivered to you exactly to your specification.
And we'll talk about why North Carolina is having a problem with this in a second, but this must scare a lot of dealers in North Carolina, does it, David?
Well, certainly. You know, they're being challenged in their only business, which is selling cars. One of the interesting things that Mike just mentioned that I learned during my reporting was that a car dealer typically does not make very much money on actually selling you a car, which is the opposite of what Tesla wants to do. If you go into a dealership, what do? You come in, you buy a car, they try to get the best price out of you that they can. They try to add on insurance and financing to get that price up.
Yeah.
But where they really make their money is on parts and service. So when you come back to that dealership and have the car serviced or you need something, they'll make their money there. But, you know, they are worried about this. I mean, without the traditional dealer model, you know, these cars will be sold directly. Tesla won't really need them. And it's really – there are two things changing here. One is we've got a new technology, which is threatening, but we've also got this new business model.
Right. Now they have a showroom in Raleigh, Tesla. Is that correct?
That's right.
And can you buy a car in that showroom, or do you just go there to look at the car, kick the tires and close the door and – test drive it? What goes on up there?
You can buy a car in Raleigh that's a little different from the one in Charlotte right now. What happened was a few years ago when Tesla came to North Carolina and they wanted to set that up, they were able to open that without a hearing on their dealer application.
Why?
North Carolina law says that it doesn't explicitly prohibit, as some other states do, automakers from selling directly. But it does say that if there are other dealers in the area who feel that it may not be in the public interest or that they're being challenged, they are allowed to ask for a hearing. And the DMV will hold that hearing and look at those issues. They'll look at whether another dealer is adequately equipped to do it, an existing independent dealer. And they'll also look at whether it's in the public interest. But as I say, 3 years ago in Raleigh, there was no challenge. I think maybe Tesla came in quickly and did this.
Under the radar?
Maybe under the radar a little bit.
They weren't taken seriously because they were just kind of a startup and they had no track record? Is that what
you think?
They
probably were not seen as quite so much of a threat. In Charlotte, in Matthews on Independence Boulevard, they've got a showroom, but it's just a showroom. You can go in there and look at it. They won't even talk to you about price. You can't place an order there. You can't buy it. But clearly, looking at the layout.
Can you drive it? Can you test drive it?
You can do a test drive there. But clearly, from the layout of that store, they would like to sell cars.
So let me get this straight. You can go online right now and buy a Tesla. Right here. We could sit on one of these computers here and buy a Tesla. We could have it designed for us and buy a Tesla. But you go to the Tesla showroom in Charlotte, you can't buy the car. They don't even have computer terminals which you could walk over to and design your own car and hit the buy button?
They have computers that where you can look at the product and you can look at the different options, but you cannot hit a button and buy this thing.
And this is because they have to get permission to sell the car here, and that's because auto dealers in Charlotte complained. Is that right?
Right. So the four auto dealers in Charlotte did raise a red flag and say, you know what, we're not sure we like the sound of this. We are going to exercise our rights under the law to call for a hearing.
So that would be Hendrick, Capital, Sonic, and Keffer.
Right.
And they have at least Hendrick. I don't know about several of these, but at least Sonic, Keffer, and Hendrick have substantial dealer networks.
These are not one-off dealers. Right. They're dealer networks, and they're big.
And therefore, a lot of money invested in this business model.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they're worried about. Yeah. You know, I mean, they could be taken out at the knees here.
How many states, Mike, have similar laws to North Carolina's that prevent Tesla from selling directly to consumers through showrooms?
Well, it sounds like what the case is in North Carolina now is that they have – the way that they're doing this is they're blocking their dealer application, not so much their – actual legal ability to operate there, whereas in several states, including Texas, Michigan, Connecticut, West Virginia, Utah, Arizona, they are prohibited straight out by law from operating dealerships. And so the ones that I named, there's straight up prohibitions in a number of states, and I don't know what the total number is, but there have been compromise legislation that's been put in place. And I should say that Tesla has virtually had a legal battle in every state over this. The dealer associations have been extremely aggressive in attempting to block their business model. And it's really not about Tesla at all. It's all about trying to, you know, prevent some sort of widespread movement towards upending the franchise model that they rely on.
And let's go back in history and explain why this model is in place. And it dates back to the early days of the automobile industry and even the Great Depression. This model was put in place to protect dealers who have to buy a lot of cars before you buy the car and take it off the lot. And during the Depression, if I understand this correctly, they wanted to keep the factories going. So dealers were forced to buy cars that they couldn't sell. And so these dealership organizations were formed to protect the business people who were actually selling the cars to us from bankruptcy, essentially. Is that right?
Well, of course, there wasn't one omnibus law that was created in all states at one time. But that type of protection is one. One of the biggest reasons for franchise laws is very simple. If you're an independent businessman and you invest a great deal of capital in building a dealership, you have an interest in making sure that the manufacturer doesn't do things like capriciously take away your franchise or authorize the construction of a competing dealership very close to you, essentially cutting your territory in half. And by competing, I mean of the same brand. So if I'm Mike Ramsey Chevrolet, and then the corporation GM says, "Oh, we're gonna let John Smith Chevrolet build two blocks down from you," that's that shouldn't be allowed. So that's what franchise laws really were created to prevent, undermining the significant capital investment that a independent business person would put in place.
And think of it as dividing up a sales territory. I mean, you don't see two dealers of the same brand very close to each other because of these laws.
But in this case, Tesla wants to be its own dealer, its own dealership network, essentially. And it met with dealers. When you come into North Carolina, if the dealers complain, you have to have a hearing. And they met with the DMV hearing, and the dealers quoted back the law as written, as I understand from your story on this, David. So what does the law require?
The law requires that they have this hearing, and the dealers will make an argument why they think it's not in the public interest for Tesla to have this permit.
Is that a difficult argument to make?
Well, we're
tongue in cheek here.
We are waiting. We are waiting for a decision from the DMV to try and to see what they think about it. But it does sound like they're talking about two completely different things. But I want to go back and maybe after our break we can talk a little bit about what Mike said before. This is not just about Tesla. I think the dealers are worried about what else could come after Tesla, and I think that's a big deal.
We'll do that. David Borax is a WFAE reporter who has reported on the situation with Tesla in North Carolina. Mike Ramsey is an automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal who joins us this morning from Detroit. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Steinway Piano Gallery Charlotte. Presenting Steinway comes to Davidson, a factory selection event featuring new and pre-owned Steinway pianos Friday through Sunday. Details at 704-223-5772. And Theater Charlotte presenting The Addams Family, an award-winning musical depicting Wednesday Addams, the princess of darkness who introduces her boyfriend to her weird family. Now through the 29th, tickets at carolinatix.org. Well, when Tony Zeiss arrived at Central Piedmont Community College 23 years ago, it didn't resemble the institution that it is today. And that's largely because of the push Zeiss gave CPCC to lead the city's efforts to become a hub of global commerce and to be a national leader in workforce development, also to expand the school's reach throughout the county. And as Tony Zeiss prepares to retire, we talk to him about that development and what he sees for the future on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Nevada Democratic Party convention erupted in chaos as some Bernie Sanders delegates were deemed ineligible, and a group of construction unions threatens to undermine get-out-the-vote efforts. Divisions within the Democratic Party and implications for turnout, the convention, and the presidential race.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In this segment, we're talking about Tesla and its efforts to open a dealership of its own here in Charlotte. And because of the laws in North Carolina, they have to jump through some hoops to make that happen because they sell direct to the customer, and that's the way they want to keep things. David Borax has reported on this here on WFAE. He joins us in our studio here at Spirit Square. And Mike Ramsey joins us by phone from Detroit. He's an automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal. As you mentioned before the break, David, this is not just about Tesla. It's about a lot more than Tesla for the automobile dealers who are trying to make Tesla jump through hoops to do what they want. If these laws weren't in place, would we see, is the fear that we would see General Motors and Ford and Toyota and Dodge, Chrysler, simply go around and do an end run around the dealers and sell direct to customers without the dealers being involved?
Sure, and Chinese automakers and those from Europe and new kinds of vehicles and other electric vehicles, all of those could be sold directly by the manufacturers if these laws weren't in place. So, I mean, I think that's really what they're worried about. Now, they would like to, and they are making a case in courts and in hearings like the one that I went to, they're making a case that they should be the ones to do it, that they've got the experience, they've got the local market and all of that. Listening to them debate back and forth over this, there's really merits on both sides. And I think, changing a business model is really hard.
Yeah. It strikes me as we've been talking about this and as I read about it yesterday, Mike, that we've witnessed a lot of changes in various different business models in the business or in the digital age. Well, we've seen the decimation of the record industry. Networks are trying to figure out, do we need local stations or can we just put an app on your phone and you can watch CBS or NBC on your phone and you don't need the local stations. Is the worry here that eventually you're going to be able to go on Amazon and buy a car?
Yes. there are a lot of things that prevent disruption. In this case, regulation has been incredibly powerful in preventing disruption. And there's an economic peculiarity that occurs with the auto dealers that makes the changing this business model extremely difficult to change, which is they have an incredibly strong economic interest in maintaining this situation. And they are very powerful at the state level in influencing politicians. They're some of the largest contributors to state politicians on an annual basis in every state in the United States. So they have a lot of influence. They have a lot of concern about maintaining this status. Meanwhile, you and I, unless we are in the position of wanting to buy a Tesla, we don't care, right? So there's no strong, we don't have a normal opposition to this. And so we don't have the ability to upend this because there isn't a hue and cry most of the time. So that, yeah, that sets up a situation that's very difficult to change.
But shouldn't we care? I mean, I know it would be in the best interest of, I would think it would be in the best interest of manufacturers to have a dealer network, not just to sell the cars, but as David, as you pointed out, to service the cars and to be there for warranty issues, etc. Wouldn't that be in our best interest as a consumer to have a place to take the car if there's a problem? Because look at the paucity of ma and pa garages around. You have to really look hard to find a garage that can service your Audi, right? So wouldn't the same be true of a Tesla, even more so of a Tesla, because it's a completely different product?
Well, that's one of the arguments that Tesla makes is that, first of all, they say that a traditional dealer couldn't sell things the way that they want them to be sold. And they've got a new technology, so they need to do a lot of education. They need to persuade some of these buyers that an electric car is something viable on the roads.
But they're trying to get a whole new car off the ground here. They're building a whole new car. Why do they want the hassle of dealing with servicing and maintaining that car directly? Why not give it to Rick Hendrick and let him do it in Charlotte. Why do they want to build the car, service the car, sell the car, be responsible for the car?
Well, you know, they've built these things. They know the technology. They've trained workers to do this. They feel that they know how to do it better than they could train anybody else to do it. And, you know, they want to maintain quality control. And, you know, buying a Tesla is not just buying a car and driving it away from the showroom. I mean, you're buying into something that's different from what you get with a lot of autos and other products for that matter. I mean, you're getting regular downloads of new software for the onboard computer. You're getting people who know about the battery. You're getting, you know, a warranty. And that's something that they want to hold on to.
But couldn't it be argued, Michael, that the same thing happens with a brand new Cadillac or a brand new Lexus or a brand new, you name it, the technicians that work in these dealerships get special training on the new versions of the product, and they're the ones that have the expertise to fix it, which is why you take it to a dealer and not to Joe Schmo on the corner.
I think that the real argument here is, why is Tesla prohibited from doing what it wants? Not so much whether they can benefit from using independent dealers. This is the argument that, frankly, I think is very hard for the auto dealers to press and make any sense. They tend to say things like, we're more qualified than Tesla to do this. But this is the United States. Why are they prohibited when basically every other business in the United States, virtually everyone, if you can think of one that is an exception to this, has the ability to sell direct to consumers if they want. Apple certainly sells direct to consumers and through independent retailers. I mean, you people make extremely expensive, purchase decisions, and they can buy direct or they can buy from a third-party retailer. Why is Tesla being prohibited from doing that?
Is there an antitrust element to this? Doesn't giving the power to traditional dealers to dictate how cars are sold to customers limit competition, and doesn't that constitute monopoly control over how cars are sold?
You know, there are arguments on both sides about that. The dealers make an argument that, well, actually, you know, we do promote competition. You can go to another dealer, whatever number of miles up the road it is, and you can say, well, I've got an offer from, you know, store A down here, and what will you do for me? And they'll bargain on price with you sometimes. Tesla is coming to the market with a no-haggle pricing model. So they're throwing that whole thing out the window, you know, and they want you to be able to come in and not have to worry about that aspect of it, but really focus on the car.
I want to come back to that, but where does the Federal Trade Commission stand on this, or have they said anything about this around the country?
The FTC has actually weighed in a limited fashion. They have done blog posts supporting the idea of direct sales by automakers. They've also written letters to some of the states where laws are being considered that would potentially strengthen laws that prohibit this. Missouri and New Jersey are two of those. They seem like they may have tried to dial back their discussion a little bit by holding a forum back in January. And Mike, you may know about this. They invited folks from all aspects of the auto industry to come in and talk about competition in general. But it really was all about this issue that we're discussing today.
In your story, David, you say that dealers argue that the current system, and you would expect them to say this, that the current system works just fine and that it saves money for buyers. Could that be true?
It could be true, and it could not be true. When was the last time you bought a car, and how did that work out?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it may be in the best interest of customers on some areas, but really it saves them money? They can make that argument legitimately, really?
Well, that's back to their argument that you can go to another dealer and get a better price.
Well, because they sell cars every day, so they know how to do it. A car buyer buys a car, what, once every 4, 5, 6, 7 years, usually. And even if you're good at it, you're rusty when you walk into the dealership, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I will say from my standpoint, it's been a while since I bought a car that way. I go through a buying service that my insurance company offers, and I just tell them which car I want, what the VIN number is, and they do the haggling for me. And I usually can get it for just a couple $100 above the base price.
You're in Detroit, Mike, so I'm sure you have contacts at the major car manufacturers. Are they happy with the current system of selling cars? Chevrolet, General Motors, Ford, are they happy with this?
Well, now you've hit on a really interesting subject. We were talking about the auto dealers. The automakers are largely silent, right? They want to let Tesla fight this out. I'm sure that that the automakers, while very supportive of their dealers, would love to be able to sell a certain number of their vehicles direct to consumers, and there's a lot of reasons for this. There is one exception to that. General Motors, who's coming out with their own electric vehicle later this year called the Chevy Bolt, has actively been an antagonist to Tesla's efforts in various states. And their argument is it's not fair for Tesla to get the benefit of selling direct when everyone else has to use these dealers, which doesn't sound very friendly to the dealers, but nonetheless, the dealers are willing to compromise and let GM and its considerable heft come in and lobby on their behalf to prevent Tesla from doing its direct sales model.
Does it save customers money? I know that when General Motors sells a car to a dealer, when the dealer sells the car, in most cases, there's a rebate to the dealer from the manufacturer. Is that correct?
Okay, so now we're going to get into an extremely complex economic discussion, but I'll try to simplify it. The short answer is you can show that it is a benefit to the consumer because of the current model that they have. However, we don't have anything to compare it to. If, for example, we had General Motors was able to get rid of its dealers and sell direct, it may just only have service centers. It would sell to you directly the car that you wanted. It might be able to lower the price of things because it wouldn't have to use as many incentives to try to move the cars. So there's no real way of telling whether we're getting a better deal or not. But I think that the dealers...
Well, if you eliminate the middleman in any transaction, aren't you saving money?
Potentially, but there's nothing to stop you from, setting a higher price, except for that where this breaks down is that they ultimately still have to compete. They're not just competing with in between dealers. They're really GM is competing with Toyota, is competing with Ford. So you really can't raise the price much because the pricing is based on a full market of cars, not on Mike Ramsey Chevy and, John Smith Chevy.
By the way, Mike Ramsey Chevy has a nice ring to it. You should think about it. do we know how consumers feel about this? Now, let's take the Tesla consumer out of the equation, because right now they are really high-dollar car buyers. These are expensive automobiles, and they should be because they're wonderful cars. I've driven one. But when you take them out of the equation, when you get to the person who buys a Toyota Corolla or a Nissan something, do they care about this? Do they really want to go to their computer and buy their car direct from the manufacturer? Or are they happy with the system as it is today?
All right. I haven't done any focus groups on this, but I'm just going to stick my neck out and say I think consumers want this. I mean, buying a car is one of the most excruciating experiences most of us have, and we're always worried about being taken advantage of. Who doesn't like the idea of going online, if it's a case where you can shop around, looking for the best price, clicking a button and getting it? Yeah. No hassle there, right?
I want to go back to the argument that Tesla makes. They say that dealers won't sell the cars the way they want them to sell the cars, with lessons on how electric cars work, the advantages over electric over gasoline, no haggling over prices, no high-pressure sales of upgrades or warranties or car loans. But there have already been no haggle dealers like Saturn, where the sticker price was the price of the car. And when Lexus, I know this from personal experience because I used to do their commercials, when Lexus entered the market, they put very strict guidelines on the dealers about how they would approach the customer, what the buyer experience was going to be like. And for the most part, they have kept those dealers to that model. Why can't they do that at Tesla?
Tesla is a startup company, and it really has only been doing this for a few years. They've got the infrastructure.
But Lexus and Infiniti were also startup
right.
companies.
I mean, I think they've made a decision that they don't want to build the extra infrastructure required to train and maintain a dealer network like that.
Dealers fear, obviously, this would open a Pandora's box of other new car companies, as you mentioned, from China and places like that, setting up direct sales network. And if that happened and those new companies were successful and they began to eat into the sales of the old line companies, would that cause those old line companies to want to do the same thing? Or would they just continue to rely on what works? They are easy, already set up, existing dealer networks? In other words, would we see General Motors jumping ship?
I'm going to say that I don't think that General Motors would get rid of its dealers. The other reason why franchises began, I mean, so we know why franchises law, we talked about franchise law, why it started, but that's not why franchises started. The reason franchises started is because Henry Ford did not want to pay for building company stores all over the country. You know, it was too expensive. And there's a second thing, which I sort of alluded to earlier. The way that economics work is that dealers are a huge benefit to the manufacturer in that they have the car is sold the minute that it ends the manufacturing line. It's already sold. They can take it off their books. It's mm-hmm. not finished goods in inventory. They don't have capital that they have invested with a long span between when they built it and when they sell it. And that actually is, for Tesla, is a financial issue, and you see it every quarter in their reports, is they have, okay, we have 3,000 cars in transit, so they have paid for the cost of this, but they haven't received the revenue for it. So,
but don't you have to put down a deposit? You have to put down a deposit before you even buy the car, don't you? I mean, with Tesla.
Yeah,
so,
but it's tiny compared to the cost okay. of the car.
Tesla founder Elon Musk has called dealer lobbying to restrict Tesla sales a perversion of democracy. Is that what it is? I'm asking two reporters to express an opinion. What a joke that is.
I don't know if it has anything to do with democracy, but when it comes to consumers having a choice, you know, I'm going to fall back on what the FTC is saying right now. And they think that consumers should have the choice of not only what car they buy, but how they buy it.
But there are a series of federal and various state laws that prevent this right now. That seems like a Byzantine thing to go through, process to go through to strike down all of those things to get what you want. Is that even conceivably possible?
Well, you know, the FTC is working on this. Tesla is working on this. Other entrants will certainly be working on this. It's kind of reverse lobbying from the top down.
So why should consumers care?
I wanted to add in something. I had a story a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was more than a month ago, about how Tesla now is considering in Michigan. There's a very important thing going on in the background. They've applied for a dealer license in this state, knowing full well they won't be approved because it's illegal. And the reason they're doing that is because they're trying to set up a federal lawsuit on 14th Amendment violations. And if they were successful in litigating that case and getting to the Supreme Court, it could essentially undo all of many of these laws on a federal basis. And so, you know, you're right, going state to state trying to fight these legislators that are backed by, you know, car dealers, it might be impossible. But on a federal basis, they have there's a lot of precedent here that they might win. A case like this.
Mike Ramsey is the automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal. David Borax reported on this story locally for WFAE News. What do you think the chances of changing the law in North Carolina is very quickly?
Not going to be a change in the law anytime soon.
We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony presenting its Night Sound season finale. Romeo and Juliet at Night Theater Friday and Saturday, performed on stage in the night and then simulcast onto the Levine Avenue Plaza. Info at charlottesymphony.org. And Bojangles featuring the Roasted Chicken Bites Combo, marinated boneless chicken made from scratch biscuit, a fixin' and drink, available all day at area Bojangles. The Nevada Democratic Party convention erupted in chaos as some Bernie Sanders delegates were deemed ineligible and a group of construction unions threatens to undermine get-out-the-vote efforts. Divisions within the Democratic Party and implications for turnout, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, and what it may mean to the convention and the presidential race that's coming up. And we will be talking about something kind of unique, actually, in Charlotte, but it's been happening in other cities around the world. Here we call it Charlotte City Walks. We find out more in a moment.
Presidential elections are historic, and All Things Considered has brought you 4 decades of election coverage.
Regardless of how you vote, I urge each of you to vote.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
We're going to choose the last president of the 20th century and the first president of the 21st century.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
Once again, this election year, we bring you the political news of the day with perspective. Listen every afternoon.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. A couple of emails about the last segment before we move on. I'm listening to your talk about Tesla and cannot help but get infuriated. There is no reason we cannot progress, like other businesses in a capitalist system, onto a different model that helps the consumer more instead of dealership group sales departments that give the industry a bad name. Anthony emails, there seems to be some corollaries in this argument with the craft beer distribution conversation that you had on your show previously. And I must tell you, Anthony, you're right. It sounds very similar to what's going on there. Moving on, you don't need wheels powered by electricity or gasoline to enjoy Charlotte City Walks. Or Charlotte's history walks, for that matter. These are walking conversations aimed at sharing the history that's tucked away in corners of the city. They're also meant to be a way for Charlottians to connect with each other and are patterned after the values of urban writer and activist Jane Jacobs, who was born 100 years ago on May 4th, 1916. In her memory, last year, people on 6 continents and 189 cities took part in walks, and now Charlotte has joined the excursion. To tell us more, we've invited Kay Penninger and Mary Newsom to join us. Kay is president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History, and Mary is associate director of urban and regional affairs for UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Let's be clear here. We're going to be talking about two different things, Charlotte History Walks and Charlotte City Walks. The City Walks are the ones that are inspired by Jane Jacobs. Is that correct? So who was Jane Jacobs, Mary?
Jane Jacobs was not a professional planner, not an architect. She was a writer and a very feisty woman who lived in Greenwich Village in the 50s and 60s and wrote a book that was very influential in how people view cities.
And way ahead of its time.
Way ahead of its time. At the time she wrote it, it was, you know, she was scorned because she was not a planner and not a an architect.
The book is
a woman.
The book is the book is called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, written in 1961, and in it she argues that urban renewal, which was all the rage back then, that's how we lost Brooklyn here in Second Ward, urban renewal did not respect the needs of most city dwellers. In what other areas that she wrote about in this book are we now coming around to her point of view?
Well, she was a big fan of mixed uses, so to speak, where you have let me back up. What she did was look around her. And she said, here's what I see in the city. Here's what I see that makes a city neighborhood work. And here's what I see that destroys a city neighborhood. And what makes a city neighborhood work is having a lot of different uses, you know, stores, shops, workplaces, residences, all close together. Mm-hmm. And what makes it not work is to have everything separated out, which was a complete upending of the zoning of the time, which is very much single-use zoning.
And very much like what we have here, where we have the city district, I mean the government district, and we have this district and that district. And I think you were part of the program. I think you were part of the program we did on North Tryon expansion, maybe? Yeah. And everything she talks about is precisely what they're trying to do with this North Tryon expansion, the Northern Expansion Project. Shorter blocks, mixed use, retail, local economies, meaning little pockets of economic prosperity because of the businesses and things in that area, and parks. Why was she so forward-thinking? Why did she see this when architects and city planners of the day did not?
Well, I think I went back and reread her book in honor of her 100th birthday, and the first chapter, she just excoriates planners for accepting theories that they learn in class instead of looking around the city. And I think that her underlying message of all her books, and she went on to write a number of other really good books, is look around you. If you're operating under a theory and the evidence in front of your eyes is that the theory is wrong, don't just assume that the evidence in front of your eyes doesn't matter. You know, re-examine your theory.
Don't confuse me with the facts. Come
pretty
on.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
So
and,
go ahead.
So what I was going to say is this theme of observe your city and know your place is the underlying theme of the City Walks that we've been sponsoring. And we've expanded it to the whole month of May because there's so much great stuff happening in Charlotte in May.
Now, the City Walks are part of – well, you're joining forces here with the Charlotte Museum of History because you've been conducting and are continuing to conduct these history walks. What are they?
Well, we call them neighborhood walking tours. So it's a way to get people out into the city to explore. People are very curious about the history of different neighborhoods here in Charlotte. So it gets them out into the city. It's very participatory. They're, you know, on the ground, walking around, and they learn about these neighborhoods, their personalities. All our neighborhoods have different personalities, and it really helps them see the history. If you take Noda, for example, it's really easy to see that Noda was a sort of a separate downtown urban area, when you're walking around down there.
And where do you find the people who know the history to conduct the tours?
Well, we've done it in a variety of ways. The first year we did it, we partnered with the Levine Museum of the New South, mm-hmm. and the tours were led by Tom Hanchett. This year, we're working with the neighborhood associations. So the residents, they really know their neighborhood. They have a great deal of pride in it. And they're also very eager to share the history.
Now, it got a little confusing when I was reading about all this yesterday because there is this combination between history walks and the city walks. But one of them, maybe both of them, are described as free walking conversations. These are obviously curated conversations, but you have an mm-hmm. expert leading and pointing out points of interest. How do you decide where these walks will be, what you'll point out, and what makes the area interesting? Who decides that?
Well, for city walks, we basically look for places where people are interested in doing walks. So we don't necessarily say we need a walk in Noda or we need a walk in University City, but we do reach out to people who we know are interested in those areas. And we, of course, reached out to the Museum of History because we knew they were doing those great history walks. And say, okay, you're doing a walk in Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was so popular, we ended up doing two walks. The museum sponsored one, and then the neighborhood resident, Nancy Albert.
Weren't there two in Dilworth?
There were two in Dilworth. One was a walk that the museum sponsored, and one was a bicycle tour that a neighborhood resident wanted to do.
Hmm.
So, there's a little bit of method to the madness, but a lot of it is just, who's interested in their neighborhood enough to want to do a tour?
Will taking one of these tours, and I'll ask you specifically, Kay, because you're with the History Museum, dispel people of the idea that we have gotten rid of all of our history?
It does. I mean, it communicates a different kind of history. It's not
not Paul Revere stood here on the night of May 5th, right. 1774. It's different.
Yeah, so we use it, to build community. So we'll pick our walk based on where we can start at a restaurant or somewhere, and everyone can gather there. Then we go for about an hour, then come back and eat. But on the walks, you'll learn, this building at one time was a restaurant. It's now a doggy bar. Or on this corner in the neighborhood, on one side of the street, you could buy alcohol. On the other side, you couldn't buy alcohol. You could buy pigs on the other side of the street, but you couldn't buy them. All this fun stuff. Or this house was used as a site to film a movie for Carrie,
right.
Carrie 2. Or this was a boarding house for single men who worked in the textile mill.
Well, this studio that we're sitting in right now was once the entrance to the Pewter Rose Restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
So
this is a great
time.
Building. And that's all about adaptive reuse, which Jane Jacobs was a huge proponent of.
Uh-huh. You have just done something called the Munching Tour, and you're about to conduct Munching Tour number 2. I'm not which
we
one
are.
Are you?
That's tonight,
okay,
actually.
Well, all right. That takes place in East Charlotte. Obviously, there's eating involved.
There's clearly eating involved. And the City Walks began in 2012, and the very first one we had was the Munching Tour with Tom Hanchett, who has just retired from the Levine Museum. And he is fabulous, let me just say. He is fabulous. He believes
he knows everything.
He does know everything, and he's so great about how he explains it. And his belief is that the corner of Rosehaven and Central Avenue is the most urban place in the city. And if you're a designer or a planner, you go, wait a minute, that's not urban at all. It's very suburban. And not only that, it's really run down. But his point is that is one of the greatest entry points for newcomers to Charlotte, because you walk down the street and there are like a gazillion different restaurants from different nationalities where people have moved here and are getting a toehold in our economy. So the Munching Tour, he starts at takes place within a block and a half of this little strip shopping center at the corner of Sharon Amity and Albemarle Road. And we're going to go to a Nepali store. I haven't been to that one. And an Ethiopian grocery store and a falafel shop run by an Israeli Arab and a bakery where they make their own phyllo pastries and three different kinds of baklava. Ask me how I know that. And he talks about the role of old rundown buildings and their importance in helping a city have an economy. It's great. Unfortunately, it's pretty much filled. Those fill up really early, and we do have to limit the number of people because you can't swarm into a restaurant.
You're also doing something. One of you is doing this tour of the University City area around transit-oriented development. So in this case, it would seem to me you're not looking at history. You're looking at the future because the Lynx hasn't even opened up there yet, but it's well on its way to being there because they're doing all this development and preparation for it. What is that tour all about? What are you going to see?
That tour is being led by Toby Holmes, who's the University City Partners planner. He's relatively new to the job. He was previously with Charlotte Center City Partners in Historic South End. And they're going to look at – there's a new parking garage going up at that corner. They're going to talk about how that garage is going to play into a vision of an urban village at North Tryon and J.W. Clay. Mm-hmm. And they're probably going to walk down on campus. I actually don't know exactly where they're going to go.
Okay. The history tours, these have been going on for a while, and are they designed for newcomers or are they designed for people who have lived here their whole lives, or both?
We get a mix of people that have lived here for a while from all over, newcomers. It's something that people are very curious about. They fill up very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We try to limit it to about 40 people so that everybody can hear and be a part of it, but people are very curious about our neighborhoods.
In both these cases, is there a lot of walking involved? Because there are a lot of people who would like to do this maybe, but who just don't have the stamina, and particularly in the heat of the summer, to keep up with this. Talk about that.
Well, we limit when we're designing the walk, that's definitely something we take into consideration. The safety, are there sidewalks? You know, what roads do we need to cross? Can we get everybody across at one time? And then we usually an hour is about it is a good time because people's attention span goes away after a while. So you walk for a little bit, you stop, you talk about a house or a building, then you move on. So you're not constantly walking, but a mile or a mile and a half is about a good stretch of road.
In the history tours, how far back does the history go? I know it depends on the area that you're in, but how far back would it go if you went to the most historic place you could find in Charlotte? How far back would it be?
Well, if we did a tour of the Liberty Walk downtown, we could go back pretty far to the founding of Charlotte, mm-hmm. to its settlement. If we did something in East Charlotte, we could probably go back. If we went back to the Hezekiah Alexander House, we could go back to 1764-ish. It just depends on, you know, where you are.
But there's some areas like Elizabeth where the more contemporary history is actually fascinating because mm-hmm. it's so close to us. We don't think of it as being all that historic, but it is because the history that you're talking about is so different from the way we live today.
Right. So we will, you know, talk about at the beginning of the streetcar suburbs and how that came about. It, you know, it just really depends on the person leading the tour, on mm-hmm. How far back they want to go as for an explanation of what they're talking about at that time.
Skipping ahead to Saturday, May 28th, that's when there's going to be a retro Uptown Charlotte walking tour. It's being led by the Charlotte Observer's librarian, Maria David, who knows everything. I mean, she has a treasure trove of stuff that we should just have it. We just do a couple of hours on her on the program.
She's great.
And she'll be using old photographs, right, of parts of the city that you'll be walking through so you can see what it looked like then and what it looks like today.
That's the plan. I think that walk meets in front of First Presbyterian Church on West Trade Street, and they're going to walk down West Trade Street. And I think she's been pulling photos from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of things that used to be there, as you know. There was apparently a famous donut shop there that everybody went to, and Mrs. Stonewall Jackson's house was there. And I don't know how many of these she has photos of, so I'm probably getting ahead of myself here. But the place where the first Freedom Riders were arrested. It was an old bus station, which of course is now a parking lot, this being Charlotte. But there's all kinds of neat stuff, and she's going to talk about it.
Charlotte being Charlotte, there are a lot of people who live here who never come downtown, haven't been downtown since they moved in, or maybe they've lived here all their lives, and they just once Belk and Ivy's went away, there was no reason to come here anymore. So if you live in Ballantyne, why would you be interested in a walking tour of Elizabeth or Dilworth or Beatty's Ford Road? Because that's one of the tours that you do. Why?
Well, you would have to be curious about the development and evolution of the city, the city's history. I mean, if you weren't curious about that, it probably wouldn't spark your interest.
And do you have people who are on the fence about that, but just take it because they're looking for something to do, and suddenly they realize this is really cool?
Yeah. So once somebody comes to one of them, they really see how cool it is and how much they learn and how enjoyable it is, and then they'll go back and sign up for more of them. So we had the day we did our morning tour in NoDa, when they saw the list of other city walks that were going on, they were like, oh, we're going to go from here and go to the walk on Johnson C. Smith University, and it really does get them engaged.
You've got two sets of walking tours here, the city tours and the history tour. How do people find out about, because it's not every day, you have them on a calendar, so how do they find out about this?
Well, I know the museum has them listed on their events calendar on their website. We have we created a special website for this. It's called citywalksclt.org.
Okay. And you can check both those websites. Charlotte Museum of History website is?
CharlotteMuseum.org.
What do you hope people take away from these two very different tours?
First. I think when people go on the tours that they really see our history in a different way. They also gain an appreciation for historic preservation and how valuable it is to hang on to that.
Mary?
And I hope people will learn to connect across neighborhoods, that the neighborhood they've heard bad things about might actually be a pretty cool place.
Okay. Mary Newsom, Associate Director of Urban and Regional Affairs with the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, Kay Penninger, President and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History, will put both of the websites up for these tours on our website so you can get connected. Thanks.